Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, a very interesting and thorough one-on-one with Ted Cruz, who I think you guys will realize is a pretty thoughtful guy when we're done listening to this conversation. So if you have some friends that are set in their ways and think, well, I don't like that guy, Ted Cruz, I think you should listen to this conversation, pass it along, and share it with them. I think they would enjoy it very much. Michael Knowles joins us at the end. But pretty revealing and interesting stuff. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock. Turbulent times, cyber criminals, well, they love turbulent times. They're sending emails, including Black Lives Matter and the subject line, to install malware called TrickBot on victims' computers. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day, we put our info at risk on the internet. You can miss certain identity threats by just monitoring your credit. LifeLock, the leader in identity theft protection, detects a wide range of identity threats like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If they detect your information has potentially been compromised, they'll send you an alert. It's LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock can see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Ted Cruz's Birthday Cocktail Party for December 22nd. Let's see who shows up. Pop singer Meghan Trainor, actor Ralph Fiennes, comedian Anthony Jeselnik, legendary newscaster Diane Sawyer, and American Idol Jordan Sparks. Enjoy your party, Ted. Now back to the Adam Carolla Show.
I give it a 4.5. Had some better cocktail parties on this show. Ted Cruz is here, Texas Senator, of course. Verdict with Ted Cruz. New episodes every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube as well. Michael Knowles also does a great job collaborating with Ted on the show. I watched a bunch of episodes last night. Good to see you.
Adam, good to see you. Last time we talked, it was on the phone, so it's good to be in person.
Yeah. Boy, a lot going on since the last time we saw you in 2015 on the phone, or at least spoke 2015 on the phone. I'm impressed of what a scholar you are of the law. That was something I was not aware of. I do a show with Mark Garagus, and I think you guys would be impressed by one another about your scholarship of the law, if that's the proper term.
Well, it's what I did before politics, and so my career was litigating in front of the Supreme Court, and frankly it's been a lifelong passion. I mean, when I was a kid in high school, I grew up in Houston and got involved with a group called the Free Enterprise Institute, where they had students study free market economics and study the Constitution, and it became a lifelong passion. The Constitution and Bill of Rights. And so I have been fortunate. I had the chance to clerk on the Supreme Court for Chief Justice Rehnquist, and I litigated. I argued cases before the Supreme Court. And defending the Bill of Rights has been, frankly, what I wanted to do since I was a teenager.
What is your take on what's going on in the country as we speak? I grew up around a hippie mom.
Yeah.
Back when hippie was sort of quaint.
Did you grow up here? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up here. And my grandmother was sort of that way too. My grandmother was like in the Communist Party and stuff like that. And it started to dawn on me, you know, when I was 9, that it wasn't so much that they loved a certain lifestyle. It's that they really didn't like this country. And they would always say, I love this country, that's why. And then they'd say something horrible about this country, about how much we need to do better and so on and so forth. And it really ultimately, from a psychological standpoint, struck me that they didn't like their dads. And that because they didn't like their dad, this country sort of became the man and their dad and the people that are pushing back against they're pushing back against a patriarchy. And the man and their dad are now just sort of pushing back against the country. And people like me, I think, are trying to make sense of it. Like, come on, this is the best country in the world. What's the problem? And they're like, well, and they keep talking about, I love this country, but I want to fix these things. But it's starting to smell to me like they don't like the country. Or their dad, or both.
And if you notice, they don't say, I love this country anymore.
So they used to do that.
They used to. And that, look, it's good for all of us to fight to make things better. That's the journey of life and the journey of our country. But you know, you look at the riots we're seeing. You look at the people, the people attacking statues, for example. Started out with Confederate statues. Okay, you can understand that. We have a debate about Confederate statues and who should be commemorated, who shouldn't. I think we shouldn't be erasing history, but reasonable people could disagree on that.
Mm-hmm.
But then you saw people attacking statues of George Washington, attacking Thomas Jefferson, attacking James Madison, attacking Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, which last I checked, they weren't exactly Confederates. Like, and it's I do think, and in fact, we saw a statue of Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, defaced, and that is no longer someone speaking out against slavery or racism. That's just people that hate America that are just trying to tear down everything that built this country. And I think that's a dangerous instinct.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out sort of where it comes from, and I remember as a poor student in the 10th grade or in the 9th grade, and I used to have these fantasies about like the school catching on fire and burning all the records, essentially.
Well, it's like Heather's blowing up the high school.
Right, like Heather's. Like I got a 1.7 GPA. I would like the Hall of Records burnt down. The kids that got the 4.0s don't want it that way. And I'm starting to realize maybe there's more people that have horrible GPAs like me who would just kind of want it burnt down. Like they just want to shake it like an Etch-a-Sketch and start from new.
Well, and there's a variety of different people engaged. There are some people that are explicit Marxists that want to see the government torn down. There are others, you know, some of these mobs, they don't know anything about American history. If you're defacing Frederick Douglass, you don't know anything about the incredible journey towards civil rights that our nation is engaged in. And if you look at Dr. Martin Luther King, he made an explicit appeal, not that our nation was fundamentally corrupt and wrong. What he said is we can do better. We need to protect civil rights. And he spoke out against grotesque discrimination, but his pitch was the principles America was founded upon are principles of equality, they're principles of justice, and we can do a better job meeting them. That's a very different pitch than the people today that are saying George Washington can't be acknowledged or Thomas Jefferson can't be acknowledged. There's a lot more ignorance behind the modern attack.
Well, I'm going to pitch you an analogy, and you tell me if you think it's apt or not. Which is, we're hearing a lot that, well, no one's for communism and no one's really for socialism, but what we'd like is a version of it that works, you know? And I've always said this analogy. I've been to Jay Leno's garage a million times. It's 4 miles from here. And one of the
Who's got a better collection, you or Jay?
he does, but I do own 13 Paul Newman race cars.
Wow.
Now. So that I got the nod in the Paul Newman, the Cool Hand Luke department. And when we're done, if you want to see them, they're half a block from
awesome.
Here. So he has his Chrysler Turbine car, and it's one-off. The Chrysler made a handful of them. They discontinued them. I think they crushed them. Maybe there's one or two on the planet. Jay has one of them. It looks like the future. It's like from 1961, it makes a great turbine jet engine sound. It'll run off Chanel number 5 or kerosene. And it's like, oh, this is the future. And he also has Model A's and Model T's, old Fords, you know, from 1919. And they look like the past. The problem with the turbine engine, it doesn't work. It seems great. It seems like the future. It seems like it has so much promise. It never worked, and Chrysler went right back to the old internal combustion engine. Same run, yep. Henry Ford put in the Model T, And that's the one who, that's the one that works. And so everyone sits around and goes, but what about the future? And it's like, sorry, the one your grandpa drove, that's the one that works. Now we can refine it. We can modify it. We can make it more efficient and we can make it cleaner. But that's the one that works. And when I hear AOC or Bernie talking, yeah. what I hear him talking is, oh no, I got another Chrysler turbine car. This time it's going to work. And I'm like, why don't we use the one that's been working? What's so wrong about that?
Well, you get a lot of people like AOC, like Bernie, like college professors that live in an ivory tower. And they defend Marxism or communism or socialism, but only in the abstract. They don't actually defend any place on earth where it's been implemented.
Right.
And over again, it has been a train wreck. It's been a disaster. Look, my dad fought in the Cuban Revolution. When my dad was 17 years old, he was in prison. He was tortured as a teenager. Cuba went from Batista, who was a corrupt dictator, to under communism. Under Castro, it got even worse. And if you look across the world, you look at whether it's Cuba or North Korea or China or the Soviet Union, socialism and communism and look, a lot of people don't know what socialism is. Socialism is the economic system of communism. Socialism is government ownership or control of the means of production or distribution. And, you know, you mentioned you said your mom was in the hippie culture. There was a time back in the 60s when those on the left were, you know, hey, be free, do what you want. Now the left is totalitarian. They want to control you. If you don't agree with them, they want you to shut up. And they want power over you. I think we ought to let people be free. And if you care about poverty, socialism doesn't work. If you want to solve poverty, there's a reason people come from all over the world to America, because America, people can start with nothing and achieve prosperity. I mean, my dad washed dishes making 50 cents an hour. That's the story of America. And you look at young people who are taught capitalism is a terrible thing. In the entire recorded history of humanity, the greatest enemy poverty has ever seen is the American free enterprise system. If you actually want people to rise out of poverty into prosperity, this is where it happens.
Yeah. Somewhere along the line, and I know I experienced this growing up, that American life, that kind of a status quo of a picket fence and a dog and two kids and a mom and a dad and you're kind of a leave it to beaver, it became sort of mockable. Like it became a joke. You know, somehow we were supposed to be on the vanguard and artists and doing something different and anything but what they did. And so what was this sort of American, unique American lifestyle became almost sort of, we looked at it like reefer madness. Like, okay, come on, why are you pitching this? We don't need to hear this crap. So we started to try to get away from essentially what works. What works is either the internal combustion engine or mom and a dad raising kids, reading with their kids, religion, faith, community, involvement. That's what works. It's basically what I always say to everyone. It's like a nutritionist saying diet and exercise. And you go, yeah, but what about this Miami diet I was reading about? It's like diet and exercise, diet, family, community, religion. That's it. That's it. Pay your taxes. Diet and exercise. And everyone goes, but it's so boring. It's like, yeah, it is. It's the only thing that works.
And it's also basic common sense. You know, I remember a book that everything you need to learn in life, you learned in kindergarten. Socialism is redistributing, you know, the old phrase, from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. Imagine in kindergarten, if the school's rule was every test we take, whatever the average score is, we're going to give to everybody.
Right.
Now, what do people do? What they naturally – are you going to study for your test? If you get the same grade, whether you study or not, what happens is no one studies. What happens in socialist economies, people don't work. And without work, you end up having misery. And it's interesting. You know, socialism and communism are pitched in terms of equality. But if you look at communist countries, look, the leaders in China – live like emperors. They have vast wealth. They have vast power. Meanwhile, in China, they've got a million people in concentration camps. By the way, you know, when I went to bed last night and woke up this morning, when I woke up this morning, I found out the communist government of China has sanctioned me last night. And they've sanctioned me because I have long been speaking out against their human rights abuses, against their torture and murder and oppression. But communism and socialism are all about inequality because those who have power get frozen in place. What you don't have in communism, what you don't have in socialism, is economic mobility. There aren't new people rising the economic ladder. There aren't new people succeeding.
Look, I always just kind of describe communism and socialism and many other things as a Rubik's Cube that'll never line up. You can spin it. You can spin it. You can hand it off to Bernie Sanders. You can hand it off to AOC. You can hand it off to Fidel Castro. And they go, oh, no, I got this. I got this. And they keep spinning it. It won't line up because it can't line up because it can't work. It can't mathematically work out. It will not. There's a reason it never has. And anyone who grabs that cube and starts spinning it around, I'll see you in 100 years. You'll never get it to line up. It's impossible.
So a couple years ago, I did three different debates on CNN with Bernie Sanders, and they were town hall debates. They were 90 minutes each. One of them was on health care. Two of them were on tax policy. And you know, it's interesting because I would point out, all right, let's socialize medicine, which the left likes to talk about. Let's talk about the countries that have implemented. Let's talk about the United Kingdom and the waiting lists that you have, the rationing where people can't get the health care they want. Let's talk about Canada. Here's a number a lot of people don't know, 50,000. 50,000 is about the number every year of what are called health tourists, people coming from Canada to America because they can't get health care because the government rations it. And it's interesting. So the response of Bernie, whenever I pointed out the failings of socialized medicine, is like, well, no, that wasn't done right. We're going to do it differently here.
Right.
And every place on earth, you know, Obamacare was pitched as the health insurance companies are bad guys. And I'm not a fan of insurance companies at all. Do you know in 2008, the profits of the top 10 health insurance companies, they were about $8 billion. By 2015, they had doubled to $15 billion. Obamacare made the health insurance companies rich because when the government is mandating a cartel, it collects a great deal of money. So when I challenged Bernie on it, he voted for Obamacare. He's like, what honor? They did it wrong. We got to do more.
Right.
And
but it's Chrysler did the jet car wrong. I got a better jet car. That's basically what I'm hearing. Everyone did it wrong, except for it's never going to work.
And let me ask a question, Adam. Why is it, do you think, that the state of California doesn't have socialized medicine today?
Right.
So we're in California right now.
Right.
California, there's a Democratic governor. There are Democratic supermajorities in both legislatures. Republicans can't stop socialized medicine. So every national Democrat says they're for it. There is absolutely nothing stopping California from implementing socialized medicine right now, except that when they looked at it, they realized it'd bankrupt the state and it would drive small business. It would drive working class people out of the state because the taxes would have to go up so far that they'd flee. Do you know how to fit all 50 states? You know how many states have socialized medicine? Zero. And the Democrats control a whole bunch of states. They can implement it, but what they want to do instead is mandated nationally so you can't flee. So you wouldn't be able to get out of California and go to Texas. They'd say, nope, everywhere's got to get it. So unless you're willing to go to New Zealand or something, you're stuck.
Right.
Their ideas don't work. You know, not even Vermont, where Bernie Sanders is from, they don't have socialized medicine. If it worked, let one of the states implement it.
Well, the fundamental flaw to many of the ideas on the left is sort of look, every creature's the same. If you go to a campsite, they say, don't leave your food out, don't feed the bears, lock the dumpsters, the bears will get into the dumpsters. We can't have the bears used to eating for free out of a dumpster. They got to go out, they got to hunt, they got to forage, they got to do what bears do. We can't just do it. And the Bernie Sanders of the world say, get the poor bears hungry. Give them some food. And you go, well, that guy seems nice. He wants to feed the bear. My feeling is always, check back with me in 10 years and tell me how the bear population is doing. Now, I know you think you're a hero, and I know you think you're doing the right thing, and maybe your heart's in the right place, or maybe you just want to get votes. But either way, you're going to bring a nice picnic basket down to Yogi Bear and feed the bear. And I go, that seems good. It's good for today. Check with me in 5 years. We'll see how those bears are doing. They've lost their ability to hunt. They're all morbidly obese and they have diabetes. And then I say, don't feed the bears. We got to teach your bears to hunt. And then everyone looks at me and goes, why are you racist against bears? Or why do you hate bears? I go, I don't hate bears. This is reality on reality's terms.
Well, let's go back to the principle we were talking about a minute ago, that everything we need to know in life we learned in kindergarten. You and I are both parents. If your child is in school and you do your child's math homework, is it good for your kid? No. And it's the same principle that, you know, I think of it from the perspective of my dad as a teenage immigrant washing dishes. I've said a bunch of times, thank God some well-meaning liberal didn't come put his arm around him and say, Raphael, you're new to this country. You're poor. Let me take care of you. Let me give you a government check. Let me make you dependent. You're destroying someone's sense of responsibility, sense of self-worth. There is value and dignity to work. Now, look, people need help, and I'm all for if someone falls on a hard times helping them. But the objective should be, just like when your kid comes home with a math homework, you don't want to sit there and do it. Your objective should be to help them do it. If you have someone who's fallen on hard times, your objective should be to help them get back to work, to help them be able to provide for their family. And the left doesn't understand that they trap people in dependency. And it's a terrible thing. It is not helping anyone to just make them dependent on government. It destroys their opportunity to really achieve the American dream.
I was sitting around on the show a week and a half ago. I said, anyone in this building born before 1974, nobody but me, I said, take a look at the opening of the sitcom Good Times I used to watch as a kid. That was Chicago. That was a black
J.J. family. Dynamite.
That was the inner city. Yeah. That was the project. It's been 46 years. It's all run by the Democrats. What has changed in you free this and free housing and low income, all with the best intentions, perhaps? Has that part of Chicago changed at all? Has it gotten any better? Has the schools gotten better? Did they ever get out of the projects? And the answer is no. It's as bad as ever was. Nothing has changed. So now we've studied it for 50 years. It doesn't work. And what I hear from a lot of people is now we have to double down. We have to do more. We have to feed more money. It's like a business that's been failing for 50 years, and the answer is we need to raise some more capital. Maybe our business plan is bad.
Well, you remember the old Saturday Night Live skit, More Cowbell?
Right.
They keep repeating policies that don't work. You look at the big cities, almost all of them have been run by Democrats for 50 years. And the policies.
Chicago's last Democratic mayor, last Republican mayor, 1931.
And their policies don't work. I mean,
they don't work because the only thing that does work is diet and exercise and the internal combustion engine. And you guys are going off in all these different directions, which I wish they did work, but they don't. So as far as that in schools, we're talking about the metaphor of doing your kids' homework for one of the things that's vexing to me is vouchers and school choice and all that. I have no education. I don't come from that world. I just look at it as first things first, competition always kind of brings out the best in everybody. And secondly, all we do is talk about the failing system, the LA Unified, Boston and Chicago, and everything's failing. I'm like, well, why not do the charter schools? I've looked at the numbers. The numbers are impressive. They've got to be better than the numbers that we're currently riding on in Baltimore and a lot of these inner cities. I get it. The teachers, unions, they're mobbed up with the politicians. How do they answer with a straight face, though, is what I'm saying? How can you be, how can you possibly, why isn't this bipartisan? How could you possibly be against school choice?
Listen, you're exactly right, and it is complete hypocrisy. School choice, I think, is the most compelling civil rights issue facing this country right now. If you look at, look, if you want people to have a chance at the American dream, education is the gateway. If you get an education, you think of every other problem we've got, whether it's crime, whether it's poverty, whether it's health care, whether it's substance abuse. If you get an education, kids are much more likely to overcome those problems. Not guaranteed, but their odds of success are much, much greater. If kids don't get an education, we know to a mathematical certainty all of those other challenges are much, much more likely. And you've got low-income kids, in many instances, African-American kids, Hispanic kids, trapped in schools that are not performing. And I believe every child in America, regardless of your race, regardless of your ethnicity, regardless of your wealth, regardless of your zip code, you should have a right to access quality education. And so I am passionate about school choice, and that means charter schools, that means scholarships, that means tax credits, that means empower the kids and parents to get a good education. And again, we were talking about what works. So I got involved in the school choice movement 25, 30 years ago. At the time, it was mostly theoretical. It hadn't been implemented in many places. And so the argument against it that was given, if we give parents and kids a choice, it'll destroy the public school system. And listen, that's an argument. If that was true, I would oppose school choice. I'm not interested in destroying the public school system. That's where the vast majority of kids are getting educated. We now know as a fact that is false because we've seen school choice programs implemented all over the country, and here's what happens. Number one's the kids that get scholarships. They end up doing better. They have better reading scores, better math scores. They get into college at a higher rate. They succeed more. But number two, and you made the point just instinctively, competition is good. In every sector, monopolies are bad. Competition is good, and when you have kids getting scholarship and choice, the quality of education in the public schools for the kids that never get a scholarship, their quality of education gets better. Now, you asked why do the Democrats oppose it? It's simple politics. The teachers' unions are among the most important financial donors and foot soldiers of the Democratic Party. And so Democratic Party, the teachers' union bosses have decided school choice is a threat to them. I actually think a lot of teachers, and I've talked to a lot of teachers who disagree with that. Look, most teachers go into teaching because they love kids and they want to give kids a better opportunity. And Democratic politicians are just siding with the money. They're bought and paid for. You look at public opinion polls in the African-American community and Hispanic community, consistently 60, 70, even 80% of African-American and Hispanic parents want school choice. And yet Democratic politicians tell them, no, I think we should fight for everyone to have school choice.
Well, first thing, I mean, I have a million thoughts. One is, it feels borderline cruel.
Yes.
To have poor inner city kids begging for a chance for their kid to get an education and a Democrat saying, no, we're against this thing that could possibly help return to the failing, dangerous school that we provide for you. That feels like a dereliction of duty. That feels like almost like a fiduciary duty. Like,
yep.
Like really somebody should be arrested for that decision. Also, you don't have to be an expert just to know that if you said basically the school system as it stands now is, you live in this place, and so you must attend that school. Imagine if car dealerships worked that way. Like, hey, you got to go to Gowdy Ford if you live within a 7-block. Well, what's Gowdy Ford's motivation for stepping up their
sure.
day? You think there's going to be dealing days or free hot dogs and popcorn for the kids on Saturday? I mean, think about what you're doing when you're selling a car. You have to... You know that people can drive 100 miles to get the best deal, and you better offer the best service agreements and the best salespeople and the best service department. I mean, think about what you have to do. Have you ever walked into a car dealer and it was a mess and the guy behind the counter was tired and ignored you and told you to wait in line and was rude? No, because you'll go right across the street to the next place. So you walk into car dealerships, they're immaculate. Someone's dressed to the nines. Hi, sir. Come on in. Have a seat. Would you like a cup of, coffee? I mean, they're competing. That's what competition does. This notion of, well, we'll get rid of the competition, but they'll still do the right thing. Untrue. Never works. Why do you think you have failing school systems? And yes, that tide may raise all boats. Not the byproduct of having school choice and vouchers and charter schools would be having the public schools upping their game as well. And the notion that you could be against something that A, just has the word choice in it. Like, you are the party of choice, and you're against something that has the word choice in it. Also, when you're talking about some of these schools that need it the most, the percentage of kids that can do math on a grade level or read on a grade level, it's so appalling and disappointing and embarrassing that the notion that you would even raise your voice to an alternative to your 10% at grade level or mathematics and reading or lower is laughable to me. And I think I heard Biden say that, you know, if he gets elected, he's getting rid of this stuff.
Yeah, Biden is all in on that, and that is what he's committed. And, you know, again, going back to your what we began this discussion with, what works. We know that this works. The rich and the middle class, they've had school choice since the dawn of time. If you're wealthy, number one, the percentage of Democratic politicians who are opposed to school choice, who have their own kids in elite private schools, is massive. So they're complete hypocrites, and they're not going to send their kids to the inner city public schools, but they're happy to trap those children in them. But if you think about it, I'll give you an amazing statistic from Cleveland. So Cleveland, a couple decades ago, implemented a school choice system. At the time they did it, a student entering ninth grade in the Cleveland public schools was statistically more likely to be a victim of violent crime at school than he or she was likely to graduate on time in 4 years.
Wow.
And you think about a single mom, an African-American mom in the inner city who loves her kids, who's struggling, and she has to send her little girl to a school where kids are getting assaulted in the bathroom, where they're not learning. That desperation. And you know what? If in a wealthy neighborhood, if in Beverly Hills, the public school had a 50% dropout rate of those who graduated, 70% couldn't read. If there was violence and assaults and sexual assaults and physical assaults in the hallways, that school would be empty. The parents there have the means to either move to another neighborhood and move into a different public school. That's a means of school choice. If you've got the means to say, all right, this school's not very good, I'm going to buy a different house, that's one version of school choice. Or to pay for a private school, but it's low income, it's poor parents.
Yeah.
Who the politicians are saying, sorry, you're stuck. The rich people can move their kids, but you don't get to. And I think the single biggest lie in all of politics is that Republicans are the party of the rich and Democrats are the party of the poor. I think today's Democratic Party is the party of wealthy elites. They're not worried about something like school choice because their kids are just fine. And my hope is Republicans are and should be the party of working men and women, the blue-collar party, the party of Ohio steel workers and truck drivers and waiters and waitresses and people that are climbing that economic ladder. And school choice, I think, is fundamental.
Well, school choice and, disbanding the police force affects the same group about the same way.
Exactly right.
It doesn't affect the people in the good neighborhoods who have the good schools and the private schools. It affects the kids and the parents in the tough areas. And also, as I was thinking about it, if you take this inner city kid we're talking about with the single mom, that the sort of archetype for what we're talking about, who would really benefit from school choice, look at it this way. You either get what you get as a young person. You either get what you need at home, meaning a strong dad, a strong family unit that can overcome, let's say, a tough school. So if you have a tough school, but you have a dad who's present, who's there, who's teaching all the hard lessons, who's staying up and doing the homework, and the mom, and this poor but proud kind of unit.
Yeah.
Then you can overcome a poor school system. But now you take the single mom, maybe working a couple of jobs, taking public transportation, not coming home till 10 at night. You have these sort of latchkey kids. You have the broken home situation. They then go into a broken school system. That's 0 for 2. And where the hell are they going to be when they're 17? The school, a charter school, good school, school that's got some discipline, school that is a meritocracy, school that, you know, I've seen it. The kids are late. They have to do 10 push-ups in the hall and hustle up and stay, come on a weekend. The teachers that are not in the union that are willing to put in the overtime and extra time, and they're getting paid accordingly. The ones that want to work Saturdays are getting paid more than the ones that knock off for the weekend. That school is the only chance that kid has, because the home is such a wreck. The only thing that's going to save him is school. And when the school is worse than the home, God help that kid when he's 18. And God help us when that kid just is out in society at 18.
Well, and you're exactly right. I'll give an example. We're talking about cars. You're a car guy. You and I both remember the cars in the 1970s when you had the big three in Detroit. And the quality of American cars was not great.
No, we had the Chrysler Cordoba,
and the
Matador, the AMC.
And then you remember the Japanese imports came in, and people were freaking out that these low cost, high quality Japanese imports were going to destroy the American auto industry.
Right,
and I mean it was a big deal in sort of late '70s, early '80s.
Sure.
And what happened is you saw a dramatic improvement in quality in cars. Remember, Lee Iacocca at Chrysler went in and said, okay, we can't have our cars breaking down anymore. We actually got to produce a product that competes. You know, you were talking about going to a car dealership. Compare a car dealership to the DMV. The DMV is a government monopoly. You don't like how they treat you? Well, tough luck. You ain't getting a driver's license. Good luck going somewhere else.
First off, I've used the car analogy a million times. You're 100% right. You can't buy a bad car now. There's no such thing as a bad Ford or a bad Chevy or a bad GM or bad anything. It's all good. It all works. There's differences, but it all works. And yes, they came in and they forced the American car companies were literally bloated. The cars were fat and bloated and slow and sloppy and not efficient. And Datsun at the time, before they were Nissan and Honda, they came in and everyone went, what's this going to do to the big three? And they went, well, it's going to force them to get their shit together. That's or die or be gone. AMC's gone. Many companies are gone. But the ones that survive are going to have to up their game. And guess who the benefactor is? We are. Anyone who wants to go, you can go out and buy a $21,000 Ford Fiesta and it kicks ass.
Yeah.
And that's who wins, just like the kids would win with the school competition.
When you're talking about bloated, you look at particularly you have inner city public schools that become bureaucracies, that have all these administrators that don't have teachers. And by the way, one of the lies politicians say is it's all money. We need to just spend more and more money. And look, money makes a difference. I can tell you in the District of Columbia, they spend $23,000 per student, and yet their education outcomes are terrible, and there's a massive waiting list of kids looking to get scholarships because they actually want to get an education. Just like the big three car companies, there was all of this bloated overhead. And what's amazing, that you look at the school choice programs across the country, most of them provide a scholarship that is only a fraction of what the public schools get. And I've Heidi and I are real involved with a scholarship program called ACE Scholarships that gives scholarships for kids to attend Catholic schools or private schools and just privately gives scholarships. And you see these schools that are making it on a fraction of what's going to the inner city public schools, that are making it on just a few thousand dollars a kid. And yet, so they can't have much overhead because they don't have the money for it. And yet you've got heroic teachers and kids that are being given a lifeline. I mean, this is civil rights. If you want – and so many politicians say, well, we can't do it. And they're willing to just let another generation of kids be abandoned.
It is – to me, it borders on criminal. And I say criminal because you end up turning a lot of people into criminals, and a lot of people get shot by the people turned to criminals because they couldn't go the right direction because we didn't give them that choice. We're going to bring Michael Knowles in a few moments. I had a joke for you and Michael. I'll wait for Michael to come in here. I had thoughts. I was listening to Ilhan Omar talking about dismantling the system, and people have been playing this clip and it's been making the rounds, and it sounds horrible. And she sounds like the world's angriest woman. But there's a part of it that I really wanted to drill down on, just one word, because everyone is talking about dismantle as being sort of the operative word. But for me, that's not the operative word in this 30-second clip that we'll play for you.
As long as our economy and political systems prioritize profit without considering who is profiting, who is being shut out, we will perpetuate this inequality. So we cannot stop at criminal justice system. We must begin the work of dismantling the whole system of oppression wherever we find it.
All right. Now, a system of oppression, dismantling, I'm fine with. Wherever we find it. Wherever she finds it, she's going to find it in a goddamn snow cone. She's going to find it in an end table. She's going to find it. When she looks, she's going to see clouds that look like oppression if she lays down on her back in a park. This thing where it's like, hey, all we want to do is dismantle oppression. Okay, how are we going to recognize oppression? Oh, wherever we find, where we find it, where you find it, you're going to find it everywhere. You're going to, every company where the guy in the corner office that started the business and owns the building, every time that guy's getting paid three times as much as the guy down on the factory floor, you're going to find it. That's the part that worries me. It's where she's going to find it. It's not where it is. It's where we find it.
Yes, and the modern left is about political power. It is about they
shut it down.
Want to control you. She's telling you she wants to be in charge of you. She's going to decide what gets torn down and what doesn't. Listen, you know, I have a lot of libertarian instincts and leanings. And the beauty of being a libertarian is you're willing to say, listen, let people be free and live their lives and make their own choices. When it comes to free speech, the modern left wants to silence anyone who disagrees. You can't have a differing view, or you will be silenced, you will be canceled. And that is profoundly dangerous. And, you know, it's interesting. A lot of young people find socialism and the extreme left attractive. And one thing I often will ask them, I'll say, you know what, I agree with Bernie Sanders. And they look at me, they're really confused when I say that. And I say, look, Bernie says Washington's corrupt. He says both parties are in on it, Democrats and Republicans. That's exactly right. He says it favors big business and special interest and lobbyists. Exactly right. The only place I disagree with Bernie and disagree with Omar is the solution. If Washington is corrupt, why on earth would you want to give Washington more power? She says the system is oppressive, so let's give the system even more power over your life. My view is, if the system's corrupt and it favors the rich and powerful, take the power out of the system and bring it back to the people.
Right. How can you oppress people with no power if you're not possessing all the power? Yeah, I found that scary. I sometimes want to ask guys like you, when I'm out here and I hear people like Maxine Waters speak, I think, oh, this lady's nuts. Like, it's not bad policy, although it's always bad policy, but I just think she's nuts. And when I hear, and I look at everything from a psychological standpoint, when I hear like Nancy Pelosi speak, I picture a person with no enemies, or I see someone that's an apex predator. Like when you see lions sleeping in the middle of the Serengeti in a big pile, and they're like, aren't they worried? It's like, no, they're not worried because no one's ever coming after them and no one's ever taken their seat. No one's ever going to vote them out. She has some sort of Democratic supermajority in her state. And she says things that no politician would ever say if they had any fear of a next election or ever being voted out. She gets asked questions about statues. We'll play the clip and made Mark Garagos laugh his ass off. And she's just dismissive about it. Like, look, I feel like you have some duty to at least answer the question. She just says things like, hey, who cares? I mean, she talks like someone who has permanent tenure, can never be fired, never has to do anything, and never held accountable. And so someone... I mean, just listen to the way she answers this question.
The city of Richmond is obviously in sync with your desire to get rid of Confederate statues, but in Baltimore and Little Italy, the statue of Christopher Columbus was removed or taken down. And I wonder if you have anything to share about that.
Well, I'm not a big, you know, I don't even have my grandmother's earrings. I'm not a big, let's see what we have in terms of monuments in this. The community doesn't want the statue there. The statue shouldn't be there.
Exactly. Shouldn't that be done by a commission or the city council, not a mob in the middle of the night throwing it into the harbor?
People will do what they do.
People do what they do is the question. I wanted the one where she said, I'm not a statue person, by the way, Max Pata, but you can yell Kalen later. But she's not a statue person. First off, we're not asking you about statues. We're asking you about civilization and rule of law and angry mobs. And for you, I live in California. I can't crack a beer and walk along the beach without being arrested. Now, and I can't say to the guy who arrests me, hey, I do what I do. That's my thing, man. I like to have a beer on the beach, you know. Somebody said mobs coming at night, tearing down a statue and throwing it in the river. And her answer was people do what they do. That's an insane answer from a elected official. I know she sides with them, but she's still compelled to say, you know what? I don't condone that. If you want to have a discussion about it, her answer was patently insane. It's also sort of angry and dismissive and passive aggressive, but it also struck me as she's got so much FU money and doesn't really care that she doesn't care what she sounds like. And she knows no one is ever going to vote her out of anything, so she just sits there with impunity. That's an insane answer for a politician to give.
She is, number one, enormously rich. She's got over $100 million in personal wealth. She is, number two, she believes she's democratically untouchable, that she'll never be voted out. But number three, her biggest protection are the media that are like Praetorian guards, and they're never going to ask her hard questions. They're never going to press her. They're never going to challenge her. And she can be hypocritical. She can be – because the media has become so partisan. Look.
Yes, that is the answer you would give if you thought you were basically in a prison gang and you're surrounded by your henchmen and no one was going to get near you. That's an insane answer to give to the media if the media – followed up and held your feet to the fire.
It shouldn't be controversial or difficult for anyone to say violence is wrong, murder is wrong, mob violence. Listen, a particular statue there, she was being asked about Christopher Columbus. There's a lot of debate about Christopher Columbus. Look, I personally am not a fan of trying to erase our history, but reasonable people can disagree with that. If someone wants to go make an argument, if there's a Christopher Columbus statue somewhere and you want to make an argument that you don't want him honored, you can have a debate about that through a democratic process. But that's not what these mobs are doing. They're coming in, tearing it down, and her attitude is, because I agree, because that mob is on my side, I'm in favor of the mob violence. And that is a really dangerous line.
Well, first off, she sounds addled, a little stupid, and partially insane. But people are going to do what people are going to do is not an answer in any way, shape, or form to really any question that's ever been asked. You're being asked a question, and you're basically saying, so what? I mean, it's not an acceptable answer if you said, hey, I run a hot dog stand and we put all the ketchup packets out and people keep grabbing all of them and we're out by lunch. How are we going to fix that? People are going to do what people are going to. It's not an answer. It's not an answer for anything at any time. That's the part that's sort of insane to me. She seems like she almost has contempt. By the way, it's so funny, these people that never get asked a tough question, when they do get asked a question that's not even tough, it's a 4.5 on the tough department, they get so angry yep. at the person. Like, she gets really dismissive anytime someone wants something. She's like, what about all these statues? Okay, I'm not a statue person. Which obviously, it's a symbol, both in its execution, and a symbol of our society falling apart, and that angry mobs can tie chains around it and pull it down and burn them on fire and throw in the river. It's not whether you're a statue person. Like, I don't have statues around my house either. I'm not a statue person. I do worry about angry groups hitting the street and vandalizing, and one of those statues got pulled down on someone and crushed your skull.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I'm not a statue person either, but we're asking about a problem.
Mob violence is wrong. This should be a simple proposition. And, you know, unfortunately, the Democratic Party, they've really unleashed, I think, the crazies in their party. If I were talking to you a month ago, just 30 days ago, and I would have suggested, Adam, the Democratic Party is going to advocate abolishing the police. You'd have said, right. Come on, Ted, that's a little nutty. No one's going that far.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they are. In terms of mob violence, you look, George Floyd's killing was horrific. It was an abuse of power. It was illegal, and the officers are rightly being prosecuted. That was, for a brief moment, actually a unifying moment where everyone agreed. They looked at that video, were horrified. This is criminal conduct that needs to be prosecuted. And then what happened is what started off as for many people, peaceful protests for racial justice became co-opted by violent rioters who engaged in physical assaults, who firebombed police cars, who looted stores, and you know, many of these stores that were burned to the ground or looted were owned by African-American small business people. Some of the most powerful and compelling images online are residents of the inner city, African-Americans weeping, saying, look, my grocery store, the only place I can go buy groceries, has now been destroyed by violent rioters, many of whom don't even live here and came in to engage in that violence. And you look at the violence and police officers who were shot. And the Democratic Party right now, they're not willing to condemn the violence. AOC said, I think yesterday, said, well, the reason for the skyrocketing crime rates in New York City is that people are out of work, and you got to understand, when people are out of going to work, they're hungry and they're going to steal a loaf of bread.
That kind of talk is, I have a thing that I say, which is stupid or liar. And in her case, it's a liar. I listened to her, and my God, these people don't have a shred of dignity. She's saying, look, people are cooped up. They don't have a job. The economy's failing. They're starving. So they go out and they steal a loaf of bread. First off, do you think that's the crime we're speaking of? Does anyone ever brought up a loaf of bread when they're discussing crime? Do you think you turn on Tucker Carlson at night and he goes, breaking news, a loaf of Wonder Bread has been stolen from a bodega? No. We're talking about physical assaults. We're talking about arson. We're talking about physically beating cops. We're talking about shooting into crowds. Nobody's talking about a loaf of bread, AOC. And you're not talking about a loaf of bread either. You've taken this thing, which is a crime, and you've turned it into this petty crime,
yep.
which doesn't exist, and there's nobody thinking about a loaf of bread. Now, for her to try to pitch that to anybody is insane. That's an insane grandiosity. You've never heard anyone say a loaf of bread. No one's thinking of a loaf of bread. And, by the way, even during good times, I don't think anybody we know would have a righteous problem with a hungry mom who had no job stealing a loaf of bread. The notion that we want that person put in Sing Sing is insane.
At the end of the day, it's not complicated. Murderers are not stealing loaves of bread. This is not Jean Valjean. She right. is engaged in deliberate political deception. And one yes. of the problems, in city after city where you demonize and you vilify and you attack police officers, consistently what we see is the murder rates go up. It's something that, that's been documented as what's called the Ferguson effect.
Sure.
Which is, look, if you're a cop, okay, right, if you're a cop, you are, and you're getting demonized and attacked, you're afraid to engage with the community. And what that results, so the efforts of the far left, they are resulting right now in more black lives being lost, because many of these most high-crime neighborhoods or low-income neighborhoods that have very significant African-American and Hispanic populations. And when you demagogue the cops, let me give you a thought experiment.
Yes.
Imagine a politician said the following. I want to take all of the police officers out of the black and Hispanic neighborhoods and move them to white neighborhoods.
Right.
Now, you would rightly denounce that guy as a total racist bigot. What do you mean? You're going to take the cops away? Don't black people and Hispanic people have a right to be protected by cops? That's what the Democrats are arguing for. Pull them out. Who do you think the victims are of these violent criminals? And they are often Hispanic and African Americans. And the Democrats are saying, just like they're saying to the kids who want school choice, well, tough luck for you. Good luck with the gangs.
It's all unintended consequences, number one. Number two, it is exactly the same as a school choice, which is the folks that need it the most are getting it the least. I don't need the extra policing in my neighborhood, and I don't need the school choice in my neighborhood. It's exactly analogous. You're hurting the people. You're proclaiming to help, and I don't even know anymore if you want to help those people. It's starting to look to me like you don't.
Too many politicians just want power. So there's a combination of ignorance and selfishness. And it's also, you know, I'm reminded of what Reagan said a long time ago about the left. He said it's not what they don't know. It's that so much of what they know just isn't so.
Yes. I make this, I talked to Dennis Prager about this quite a bit, which is starting to have to make the distinction between liberal and left. I think of myself as liberal. Dennis Prager is very conservative, but he thinks of himself as liberal. I definitely think of myself as liberal. What's going on? And the left and liberal used to sort of be the same thing. There's a distinction now between being liberal, who almost everyone I know is liberal, and then this sort of AOC, Bernie Sanders, that kind of leftism, you know, pull back the cops and, you know, everyone has an undefined gender and all this kind of stuff. That this is not the kind of liberal thinking that I sort of grew up embracing. And I don't know how – do you have thoughts on that?
So look, I mean, a classical liberal, which I've always considered myself, is someone who defends liberty, defends the liberty of the individual. Now, that word has been co-opted, and you're right that the hard left, they're statists. They believe in government power. They believe in you know, I was out in California a couple of weeks ago. Heidi's family's from California. We were out, and I was visiting with a woman who's a kindergarten teacher. And she told me, she said, listen, I'm really afraid right now. She said, there's a McCarthyism in the air that I'm afraid, like, if I say the wrong thing, I'll be fired. So she's like, I just won't say anything. I'm just like, you know, you may know the name. I guess there was a soccer player here in L.A. who, professional yeah. soccer player, was fired
wife tweeted some stuff out.
I mean, what the hell is that? And it's important to understand, look, there's sort of a, well, both sides do it.
Alexander Kate or some version of that, so my producer says. Yeah, no, I agree. Well, let's not remove everyone from their livelihood. Also, I don't know, you know, I'm not a politician, but these guys were earners. They were taxpayers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let them contribute.
And people have a tendency to think, well, everybody does it. But actually right now, that's not true. So it's the left that is calling for censorship. It's the left that is silencing people. So it's, you know, you don't see people on the right. I'm not saying silence Bernie Sanders. I'm not saying silence AOC. I'm actually happy for socialists. The more they talk, the less it makes sense. And so it's not like both sides are saying silence the other side. It's one side that are saying, if you dare disagree. And I'll give an example. Steven Crowder.
Right.
Who I've done a show a number of times. As you know, YouTube has demonetized him. I sat down with the CEO of YouTube, and she explained to me. She said, well, look, he didn't do anything to violate our policies. So she conceded that. He's entirely consistent with their policies. But she said, look, you should be glad. We just cut off all his revenue. We didn't take him down, which is what we were being pressed by the left to do. And I said to her, I said, listen, Susan, it's only one side. I'm not saying silence the other side, and you shouldn't feel glad. What an Orwellian concept. Would it be a problem for your show if you were magically demonetized and all your revenue disappeared?
I know. It's this thing of like saying, we didn't say you can't speak on our college campus. I mean, you can't speak on our college campus. We didn't say you couldn't speak. Go in that mop closet and talk. Like, okay, but how do I support my family?
And by the way, we won't protect you if they actually physically assault you, which
right.
Too many college campuses that's happened.
I'm going to challenge you because I saw a tweet that said, Cruz said we should boycott Nike, but he's against boycotting Boya Foods or whatever the food is. Can you explain that?
Yeah, no, that's actually, it is a fair point. So look, I do think any one of us has a right to boycott someone. That's part of free speech. You can express, all right, I don't agree with this or that or the other, and you have a right to do it. And, you know, with Nike, so I've actually my whole life, like I think every like tennis shoe I bought, every short T-shirt, I was always a Nike consumer. And Nike finally drove me over the edge because they just seemed to be going, leaning in over and over again on embracing anti-American sentiment, on sort of feeding the, whether it's, you know, making Colin Kaepernick their you know, kind of lead spokesperson, embracing kneeling for the flag. And I just got to a point where I said publicly, all right, I'm not going to buy their products anymore. I do think there's a difference, and it's a difference of degree. It's not a categorical difference. What you see on the left is they're trying to cancel anyone that deviates any regard. So Goya Foods, look, I'm Cuban. I grew up eating Goya Foods, black beans, my whole life. You know, there's a whole movement on the left to try to cancel Goya Foods because their CEO said positive words about Trump. You know, your buddy Jimmy Kimmel is facing an assault right now. Because years ago he did some comedy routines where he wore blackface, and there is an excessiveness to the cancel culture on the left, and I viewed Nike, I actually spoke out against it several times, and they kept getting more and more extreme, and I decided, all right, I'm out. And I think there's a difference between trying to do that across the board to everyone versus a threshold where you have a right to say, all right, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Well, it sort of feels to me like once in a while you hear people go, well, you know, you got CNN and they have one sort of, they go one direction, and you have Fox and they go another direction, and they go, okay, so it's even. And I go, no, there's the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, MSNBC, ABC, all the major networks, all the major newspapers, and Fox. So it's like this thing of pretending like, well, there's... You boycott Goya, they boycott Goya Foods, you boycott Nike. It's like, no, it's not an even thing. It's everything all the time versus picking and choosing certain moments. And you can say, well, maybe to be completely consistent, then you should call for no boycotts of anything at any of the time. But what we're kind of saying is I think that left you're talking about is trying to cancel everyone all the time.
It's a hair trigger as a tool of domination and censorship. And look, boycotts have been – you look at Dr. Martin Luther King and, for example, the bus boycotts. I mean, they are a tool that you can legitimately use, but the left is trying to use it. When you fire a soccer player because his wife tweets, all lives matter – That's crazy.
Well, the craziest part of this whole new world we're living in is the, you know, editor at the New York Times with the Tom Cotton op-ed piece. Like, it's someone's opinion. You're allowed to share someone else's opinion. It's an op-ed.
And it's the ideological intolerance. Sadly, it was fostered at many of our universities where they had this culture. And now The graduates come out of the universities and they're the 20-somethings. And so what happened at the New York Times is the 20-something reporters and staffers essentially like rose up in an outrun. They got the editor of the New York Times fired because he dared publish an op-ed from a sitting U.S. senator. By the way, if you disagree with it,
right,
argue on the other side. I will say that's one of the reasons I think podcasts are doing well. I think that's one of the reasons people listen to your show. I think that's one of the reasons my podcast Verdict is we're getting lots and lots of people signing up and subscribing is because so much of the media is so biased that actually having a real conversation, you can't have that on CNN and you rarely have that on Fox. Both sides are pretty biased.
I agree. They are essentially doing the version of sort of the example I use is, you know, Two Live Crew came out with a rap album. A bunch of Tipper Gore types got against it because of language and misogyny and everything else. And it was an album that probably could have came and went, sold 100,000 units. Instead, it went triple platinum because they raised their voice. And I think when you look at podcasting and you see so many different variations and honestly, a lot of conservative podcasts, you know, I've been doing this for almost 12 years. There were no conservative voices in the top 100 of the Apple podcast community ever until recently. And the reason there's so many folks now inhabiting the charts of iTunes on the conservative side is because that's the group that's being silenced by CNN and beyond. And so they're creating this almost black market of ideas called podcasts. And in a way, they're going to hurt their own business. Because people are going to stop going over there for business and move over to other platforms where they can hear alternative ideas that they weren't fostering. I need to take a hit a quick spot here. We're going to bring Michael Knowles in real quick. And I got some ideas and possibly some comedy for you two. First, I'll tell you about Geico. Right now, Geico is offering an extra 15% credit on motorcycle and RV policies, 15% on top of the money they're already saving you if you're going with Geico. So what are you waiting for? You need to head on over to Geico. Never been a better time to switch. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit geico.com and learn more. Save that 15% by October 7th at geico.com. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll bring your partner in podcast crime, Michael Knowles, in. And we'll finish up with him right after this.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Michael Knowles' Birthday Cocktail Party for March 18th. Let's check out the guest list. Singer Adam Levine. Ooh, it's Queen Latifah. Vanessa Williams is here. So is Brendan Schaub. The 22nd and 24th President of the United States. Grover Cleveland, Mike Rowe, and Dane Cook. Have a good party, Michael. Now, back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Yeah, I think I'd rather go to Michael's party than Ted's party.
Yeah, he's beaten me on that. Although I will say, so it referenced, all right, I'm going to just sort of make a sort of geekish admission. A few years back, I wrote an op-ed, and I talked about, a lot of people know Trump is the 45th president. And so most people think, okay, there have been 45 presidents. And so I wrote an op-ed, I think at the time Bush was president. So I've said there are 43 people who have been president of the United States. And I got corrected that that was wrong. So Trump is not the 40 – he's the 45th president, but only 44 people have been president of the United States because Grover Cleveland was president twice non-consecutively. Mm. So that there are only 44 people, but there have been 45 presidents. And so I got corrected on my op-ed. And there you go, a little bit of history.
Michael Knowles here does his own podcast as well as host, for lack of a better term, although it's a lot of give and take with Ted Cruz as well. Michael, I think I saw you sort of backstage, for lack of a better term, over at Ben Shapiro's place last.
That's right. I'm trying to think. The last time was either at Shapiro's place or at Dennis Prager's birthday party.
It may have been Prager's birthday party. Got it. You know, there's a few guys. I don't know if you guys feel this way, but like you hear about celebrities sort of coming and going, and they're guys you like or guys you thought that were funny or talented. And, you know, sometimes, like, I remember when I heard John Candy died, and I was like, oh, that guy made me laugh, you know. But every once in a while, when I think about Dennis Prager's voice not being with us, when I think about not being able to turn that guy on and hear that guy, or who, I wonder, you know, we all, something happens on a Sunday and you think, I wonder what Dennis has to say about this. That guy's voice, and in a world where there's many funny people, many smart people, many people that have a lot of wisdom, I always think, God, what's the world going to be like without that guy's voice, right?
I know. It's true, literally, and then obviously the things he talks about as well. But he also just has a literally distinctive voice. The way I always judge if someone is saying the right things, if they're important in the culture, is how many times their political opponents try to get them fired. And for Dennis, I think it's just about every day at this point.
Well, I'll give it a Prager example. So I had Dennis testify at a hearing I chaired on censorship and social media. And one of the things he discussed was how YouTube censored PragerU's output. And the one that I thought was the funniest is they censored a PragerU video on the Ten Commandments because it discussed murder. And it was just like, is this the Onion? And he's like, well, you know, and as Dennis testified, he said, yeah, I'm saying thou shalt not murder. How is that? And they deemed it adult content because it was discussing murder. And it's, you know, it's pretty ridiculous.
I was listening to one of your podcasts or video casts or vodcast, or I was listening to Verdict with Ted Cruz, and I was watching it. And it was one, it was a couple of episodes back, but we're talking about abolish the police. And I think you brought up abolishing ICE.
Yeah.
And how insane that sounds. And I'll let you in on a little comedy bit I do on occasion when they used to let you do stand up, which was ICE and AOC, and everyone wants to get rid of ICE. And I just think it's the acronym, which is Immigration Customs Enforcement. And I said, you know, ICE was the name of the douchebag pilot in Top Gun. That was Val Kilmer. He was Iceman. And ICE also sounds cold and heartless and tough. Like, and so the AOCs of the world and the rest of that ilk is like, abolish ICE, abolish ICE. We don't need ICE. And everyone's kind of like, yeah, what do we need ICE for? These cold, brutal guys. And I said, all you got to do to keep ICE, and Ted, I really do mean this, and I think you should go push for this when the time comes. Immigration, custom enforcement. Start it with the word national. National immigrant. Who would want to abolish NICE? No one. Who in their right mind is going to stand up in the Senate floor and go, we got to get rid of this NICE? Nobody's going to want to get rid of NICE. No one's going to want to go on record is getting rid of NICE. And you just put national in front of it, and it goes on for a thousand years.
I think you have a brilliant solution. It reminds me of years ago, the FBI had a law enforcement tool. And it was some of the sort of early internet monitoring, and it was called Carnivore.
Right.
And it was a whole big thing. And I remember thinking, what a terrible name. Like if they'd named it Fuzzy Bunny Rabbit. You know, if it's Carnivore, you're like, okay, what is this? It's like a T-Rex coming after me. And it's the same, you know, language matters.
These acronyms can get you in trouble. It reminds me of when they dedicated this law school to the late, great Justice Scalia, whom you knew very well. And they decided to call it the Antonin Scalia School of Law. That's not how you want people to refer to your law school. I think they changed the words around a little bit.
The other thing in the comedy department, and stop me if you've heard this one before, but I kept thinking, Ted Cruz always reminded me, your voice, your cadence and your mannerisms reminded me of a character actor I used to hear growing up. Now, if you've heard this one before, you know what I'm talking about. And I haven't even heard it. I've just heard it in my head. This guy was named Pat Buttram. It's an exaggerated version of you, but it still reminded me of you. He was a very popular voiceover guy. He did a lot of Disney movies in the 70s and stuff, but known best as from the character of Mr. Haney from Green Acres. So, Chris, you have a snippet of Mr. Haney. Now you have to close your eyes because if we look at it, it's not gonna work. Let's see.
Just looking up the meaning of that word in this new handy pocket dictionary, which I am offering today for only $1.
Anything?
Where can I buy it? I don't, oh, I'm sorry.
Look, you know, to be honest, all politicians are frustrated actors. And so if I could have been Mr. Haney, sign me up. I did high school theater, but I didn't have the chops. I didn't have the talent. You know, you were an actor here in Hollywood before the podcasting world pulled you in.
But you know what people say? They say politics is acting for very, very attractive people. So
that's not exactly that quote is.
No, okay. All right. Never mind.
So, by the way, speaking of Green Acres, have you seen the video of Trump singing the Green Acres song?
No.
Oh, no. He did this at the Emmys. No. If you Google it, your producers can find it in 30 seconds. He's literally in farmer's overalls singing, you know, Green Acres.
Oh, it sounds familiar.
I mean, it was pre-politics, but it's a fairly surreal video clip.
It was in a world where, you know, Gilligan's Island, Green Acres, like they laid it all out in a 45-second song. Green Acres laid it out. Like Manhattan is where she'd rather stay. She gets allergic smelling hay. She enjoys a penthouse view. It was so, and she said, darling, I love you, but give me
Park Avenue.
Right. And I grew up in North Hollywood in a little crappy house in the valley, and I had all this Park Avenue and penthouse stuff and furs and jewels and stuff. I was just looking at it going, where is this? What goes on?
And I got to say, Adam, you know how to hurt a guy. You say, gosh, you reminded me of a popular character actor. And I'm thinking, all right, Sean Connery, yeah. James Bond,
Cary Grant,
Superman. Then you said Disney, and I'm like, all right, who's the guy that voiced Hercules? And then you go, no, Mr. Haney from Green Acres. It's like,
well, that guy, if you look at that guy's IMDb page, he must have done thousands of jobs. But you're right. Nobody wants to be compared to Pat Buttram. He even has a weird name. Sort of homoerotic. So are we good? How are we in good terms with Kimmel? How did that thing end? And I'll tell you my version, not my version of it, but I know you guys played a day before Father's Day because, or maybe 2 days, or a day or two before Father's Day, because every Father's Day, Jimmy rents out the UCLA girls softball field. And we do a big Father's Day softball game with all the kids and the ice cream truck and food truck. And it's a great. And I showed up that Sunday and I said, where's Jimmy? And the answer was, he's in bed. He can't move. And I said, what's going on? It's like he pulled every muscle in his body playing Ted Cruz in basketball. And he literally can't move. And I was like, all right, well, as long as he's still paying for the ice cream truck, though, right? It's like, yeah, all right, I'm going to go get a double. So he literally said he couldn't move. I know the game went on longer than it should have.
Yep.
There were probably less prolific scoring than we were looking for. But you won 11-9, and they supposed to go to 15. How are the terms with Jimmy? How are you guys? How do you finish with it?
So they're fine. I mean, the whole thing, that was surreal and as much fun as I may have ever had. And sort of where that, you know, people hear, you know, Ted played one-on-one basketball with Jimmy Kimmel, that sounds pretty bizarre, and it is pretty bizarre. People wonder, well, where did that come from? Where it came from? So I'm a diehard Houston Rockets fan. And I had been, you know, so I go to a lot of Rockets game. I was at Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals when Golden State beat us.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy went on TV the next day and put a picture of me at the game and blamed me for the loss. Said the reason that the Rockets lost is Ted was there and he cursed the Rockets. And so I got a little irritated. So I jumped on Twitter and I said, all right, big guy, you talk a good game. Let's settle this man-to-man, one-on-one hoops. The loser gives $5,000 to the charity, the winner's choice. And I actually suggested you as the ref. I said, look, let's have Adam ref it. We'll do this. Jimmy comes back at me at Twitter, and we're tweeting back and forth. It's very funny. Heidi was in bed. It was past midnight, and like I'm sitting in the bedroom. The lights are out, and Heidi's like, Ted, come to bed. And I'm like, no, I'm in a Twitter war with Jimmy Kimmel. I can't right now. And it ended up happening. We played one-on-one. It may have been the worst game of basketball in the history of mankind. We beat the living crap out of each other. I mean, neither of us wanted to lose, and we were – I mean, There were so many fouls. The next day when I walked in the bathroom, how he looked at me, I probably had 50 bruises up and down my torso because we were just, I mean, elbowing and punching. And it was, you know, ESPN, when they were broadcasting, 6,000 people come out and watch it at Texas Southern University. And ESPN said at the time, if Dr. Naismith saw what happened here, he would have invented a different game. I mean, it was terrible, but it was fun, and we ended up raising over $80,000 for charity. So it was – Jimmy was a good sport to do it, and he showed up and had fun with it, and I'm glad at the end of the day to have won. Neither one of us wanted to lose, and at least that day it worked out.
Good. I'm glad because, you know, I do feel I find myself in this position a lot, knowing a lot of – comedians and left-leaning people and folks from Hollywood, and then also knowing your Ben Shapiro's and your Dennis Prager's of the world and types like that. I always go, first off, I wouldn't be friends with bad people. You know, it's kind of a weird jump to make, a leap to make. You know, you go, well, you're friends with Jimmy, he's a good guy, but then you're friends with Dennis Prager, he's a bad guy. It's like, why would I be friends with a bad guy? Why would I be friends with a racist? Why would I be friends with a hater?
Sure,
you know, what are you saying about me? And if you two, whoever you are on the right and whoever you are on the left, if we all went out to dinner, you guys would enjoy the shit out of each other's company. Right. You have a ton in common. Also, you both live your lives the same way. You're super family oriented. You pay your taxes. You're good in your community. You're good citizens. Like you both, the thing that's comical is you live the same life. It's not even like we're talking about that guy's he's pagan. That guy's into Santeria. And that guy's a Jehovah's Witness. You know, you guys live the same life.
I'm Cuban. Don't be knocking Santeria.
You both live the same life. That's the comedy.
But you have this kind of unique position, Adam, which is I think you're the only guy in Hollywood who is friends with Jimmy Kimmel and Ted Cruz, right? You occupy the space where you're friends with people on both sides. So it seems to me like if there's a coronavirus super spread in L.A., it could only be you because you're the one who's spread
point.
The both halves.
Yeah, I'm the bridge who brings it from one side of the aisle to the next. There's a freedom and sort of being an atheist and a freedom and not being educated and a freedom and just sort of growing up with no self-esteem that I just float around and go, I like that guy. And they go, yeah, but you know what that guy thinks about that? I go, I don't know. I like that guy. And I like that guy over there. I don't – this notion, which is dangerous, is sort of everyone's got to pick a major.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and they do it in comedy. I mean, in comedy, it's like you can't like Letterman and Leno. And I'm like, why couldn't you like Letterman? Because you got to pick. And it's like, really have to pick? Why? That's all self-imposed. Yeah. We're making all that up. You don't have to pick that.
Well, and I think it sucks what has happened to comedy. That look, Donald Trump's election, I think it's broken the media. I think Hollywood has lost their mind. And comedy, like, look, I love good comedy. I grew up watching an SNL. Like, I like watching the late night shows. And by the way, I like laughing at both sides. I mean, I'm perfectly good with, you know, make fun of Republicans, make fun of Democrats. There's a lot to make fun of. But what's happened in the last couple of years, and Jimmy, you know, I've done his show. I think Jimmy is one of the late night comics who you've seen in the last 4 years of Trump's presidency sort of move left where the entire monologue is all about attacking Trump. And Colbert is worse. Colbert just sort of is a partisan scream. And it'd kind of be better to be like, okay, fine. I got it. You don't like Trump. Okay, we got that. Can you tell any other joke? And listen, I think Jimmy is somewhat trapped by the crazy political world of Hollywood. You know, I mean, as you know, there's a big effort to try to cancel him. I don't think they should cancel him. I'm speaking up for him, and it's the left that's coming after him. I mean, there's some irony. He tells a lot of jokes at my expense. Okay, that's fine. That's good comedy. I wish, you know, so much of comedy, it used to be, all right, one of my favorite movies, Team America.
Right.
Team America is absolutely hysterical, and it skewers both sides. I mean, it skewers both sides beautifully. Right now in the comedy world, they're only making fun of one side, and it's too mean-spirited. It's not funny anymore.
Well, you know, this story goes, which is, you know, somebody, I was talking about this the other day on this podcast, which is like Johnny Carson, and there's a kind of misnomer that he didn't do political stuff. No, here's what Johnny Carson did. He did political stuff, right and left. You have to do political stuff. You do a late night show. That's the news cycle. You have to do it. But here's the difference. We didn't know what his politics were.
Right.
I think that's what we're saying. It's not don't do political stuff. It's when you're done doing your political jokes, right and left, go home. And at the end of the day, I have no idea where you stand. And frankly, I kind of like you like an umpire. Like, I don't want to know your favorite team. I just call balls and strikes. And I'll enjoy the game.
And after Carson, Leno did some of that too, where he would make fun of both sides, and that's good comedy.
I had a funny, I had a funny response to. I was talking to Dave Rubin, and he said, "You know, there's a fair bit of Republicans out there in Hollywood and comedy and stuff like that." He said, "But how do you know? Like, how do you know who's a Republican, or how do you know who's?" Leans to the right or is more conservative. I said, it's easy. Just figure out the comedian, figure out the commentator, figure out the personality, and find out the ones that don't say anything.
Yeah.
And then if they don't say anything, then you know. That's the secret handshake.
That is, it's so odd though, because you remember back when there was FOA, the Friends of Abe, this kind of secret conservative thing out here, there were a lot of people. There were thousands of members, but they were all too afraid. I mean, genuinely believed their lives would be ruined if they were photographed at one of these events, and maybe that would be the case. A lot of them were blacklisted. How do they have that power? If there are thousands of them, then why don't they just speak up? I never understood it.
Well, and that's actually where Michael and I first met, was through Friends of Abe. And I remember back in 2013. So Friends of Abe, as you know, was this gathering of conservative, right of center, libertarian people in entertainment. And I came and spoke, I think, in 2013.
Yeah.
And they had about 400 or 500 people, that big crowd. And I have never in my life before or since spoken to a group where people were so afraid. They had a rule, no photographs. You know, everyone takes cell phone pictures of everything. No photographs. And it was not – now, there were a couple of high-profile people. So John Voight was there. And he was sort of a big enough star that he could get away with it. Actually, a person I met there was Bruce Jenner when he was Bruce Jenner.
Yeah.
He was there. But you had, you know, gaffers. You had key grips. You had lighting guys. You had makeup people who were terrified. If I am photographed here, if anyone finds out that I'm not on the left, I'm unemployed. And it was – I actually think if we had gone to a Satanist devourer of live kittens convention, they would not have been as afraid as they were. And there's a McCarthyism that's not a good – and that was in 2013 before Trump. So where it is today is orders of magnitude worse.
Well, it's a perfect storm of, you know, I'm a carpenter and I've worked with a lot of carpenters and I've worked with a lot of guys who do a lot of fabrication work and real good at building race cars and stuff like that. When you have a real viable, tangible skill, you'll always be employed. Because people always go, I don't care what I think of that guy. That guy does kick-ass carpentry. I'm getting him over to my house. You'll never be out of work. You have a sort of impunity. Hollywood's different.
Yep.
Anyone. You know, you see all those movies where you go, you know, it was going to originally supposed to play the part of Superman. They named Tom Selleck was originally. And it's like, yeah, that's right. Everyone is interchangeable.
Yeah.
Everyone could be swapped out. There's three or four guys that really are untouchable, and then everyone else below those guys, everyone realizes it's a popularity contest. We're back in high school, and you could get voted out into the cornfield, and they understand it.
And to be fair, Tom Selleck couldn't play Superman because he can't shave the mustache, and it just – it wouldn't work with Superman with
the character. That's true. That's a good point.
But they understand it, and by the way, not only understand it, they've seen it happen dozens and dozens of times. The A-list actress that was hot and red hot and on fire, and it's like, and you go, you know how you know? You go, well, what's her name? What was the girl from the? I can't even remember.
So let me give you an example, an A-list example. Do you know who has not appeared in a major movie in over a decade?
Christopher Reeve.
Okay, true. You got me there.
Well, I was on the Superman.
All right. So that I can't blame Hollywood bias, but I
still do.
Richard Gere.
Oh, Richard Gere. Oh.
Richard Gere, because he spoke out for Tibet.
Oh, Tibet.
He took on China. So I actually had a chance to meet Richard Gere. He came to the Senate and was speaking out against Chinese oppression. And go back and look. And, you know, he was in a ton of movies as an officer and a gentleman.
Every movie.
And, I mean, he was an A-list, like, you know, major star. And go pull up his list of films in a decade. No major studio will hire him because he's dared criticize communist China, and it doesn't matter if you're Richard Gere, you're done. You're doing small independent films because we're distributing to China and we want to make a buck.
That China issue, it kind of shows it to me too, because it is just about that buck. And, you know, we talk a lot on the show about, like, the oppression, the systems of oppression, the institutional oppression that the left is always prattling on about. But the left controls all of those institutions, right? The media, Hollywood, big tech, administrative government, all these sorts of things. And so it does seem to me at this point, if even Richard Gere can be effectively canceled because he speaks out against the Communist Party of China, you kind of just have to build the pirate ship, don't you? You kind of have to do exactly what you did.
Look, for people who never stop talking about paying your fair share and blah, 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 10 years ago I was doing a show in Winnipeg, of all places. And it was the middle of the winter, and no one should go to Winnipeg in the middle of winter. But anyway, I was getting walked to my room, and the guy who was walking my room in the hotel said, you know, is it the room in the end, the suite at the end? And I said, who? And he said, Samuel L. Jackson. And I said, why? And he said, because you're shooting a movie out here. And I thought, where's the movie supposed to take place? It's like, supposed to take place in Chicago. He's a cop. It's wintertime. They're trading out Winnipeg for Chicago. Samuel L. Jackson is one of the biggest voices of pay your fair share and pay your taxes. He lives in Beverly Hills. Who's the first guy to hop on a plane and go to Winnipeg and shoot a movie to save a couple of dollars in taxes and credits? Samuel L. Jackson. So the group who talks the most about doing the right thing and what's wrong with paying more and blah, blah, are the first people to hop on a plane. I drove Bryan Cranston to the Burbank Airport from this studio because he's shooting Breaking Bad in New Mexico. He's a very liberal guy. He's all for, you know, raise the taxes and blah, blah, blah. But I'm also giving him a ride to New Mexico to shoot 4 or 5 seasons of Breaking Bad. That's how people work. And to come full circle.
And Breaking Bad was so good. I watched every episode, and it was – and it's a little bit funny that he was the dad on Malcolm the Middle. I mean, it's a like holy cow, talk about like Ward Cleaver suddenly is a meth dealer. That was a pretty dramatic shift.
That is because he's a great actor. Yeah. But it's funny getting back to McCarthyism. One of his last roles or bigger roles was Trumbo, was the writer who was blacklisted during McCarthyism. And once I had Dinesh D'Souza on this show, and Brian shot me an email, and he said, you shouldn't have Dinesh D'Souza on your show. And I said, why not? I said, well, the guy shouldn't be talking. You know, basically, I don't approve of that guy being on the show. And I thought, you're shooting a movie called Trumbo right now about McCarthyism, about someone with an opinion that's different than the mainstream opinion being silenced, and you're explaining to me that Dinesh D'Souza shouldn't be welcome on my show. That's where we're at.
Seems to me that one of the casualties of the plagues and everything we've been living through, social and otherwise, is irony. There is no irony left.
Well, the point is, Brian's a great guy. He's a talented guy, and I love that guy. But that's the way they think now, and they don't understand. What they think is, he's a bad guy. He shouldn't get a microphone.
Yeah.
My feeling is let's hear everyone's ideas, and then let us decide who the bad guys are.
Well, and look, free speech, diversity, being willing to accept that people are different. There are all sorts of policies. I'm a big believer, which we started the show by talking about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. One of the really genius ideas at the heart of this country, at the heart of the Constitution, is federalism, that we're 50 states and we're diverse, different states. And we can have totally different policies, and that's okay. Let's take something like drug legalization. So personally, I'm not in favor of drug legalization.
But at the same time, I think it's a question for the states. And so if some states want to legalize pot and other states don't, I think that's a reasonable decision. And we ought to have a little more tolerance of diversity to say, okay, you can do different things in different places. And one of the advantages is that you can see what works. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis talked about the states as laboratories of democracy. You can see what policies work and what don't, but today's left doesn't want to see that. They want to see whatever they believe mandated for anyone and anyone who dissents driven out of society. And that – I don't think that makes any sense.
It doesn't make any sense, and it's also big picture – mathematically impossible to ever work out in any way that we would find satisfactory as Americans. It's just impossible. Even the ones who want it the most are going to suffer under its regime.
But doesn't this also raise this issue of whether or not we can even speak to each other? I mean, I've seen this on these college campuses in recent years. All the kids in college and their professors will say, there's no such thing as truth. Truth is relative. There's your truth. There's my truth. There's this truth. If there is no objective truth, right, if the language that I use is not the same – basically the same language that you use, we can't communicate. And then politics just becomes this brute battle of interests and burning down the country and pulling down statues. Isn't that what we see all around us?
Well, and if you're comfortable with what you believe, if you're confident – you and I talked for 10 minutes about school choice. I'm happy to talk to any leftist about school choice all day long and talk about it on the merits. But if you're afraid
– yeah.
If you're a socialist and you know that your ideas don't work, then you're afraid of people who have differing views. You know, Reagan had a great way of putting it. When the Berlin Wall divided East and West Berlin, the way Reagan put it is he said the thing that the left never seems to notice is the machine guns all point in one direction. People are fleeing communism and coming to freedom. As a Cuban American, the way I like to put it is the thing left never seems to notice down in Key West, the rafts are all going one direction. Just once, I'd like to see some socialist get on a little inflatable raft and head 90 miles south to the utopian socialist paradise where there's misery and poverty and suffering. It doesn't work. If you're comfortable with what you believe, you should be more than comfortable having someone disagree and then having a discussion on the merits. And if you're trying to silence your opposition, it's a sign of weakness. And we see that especially in college campuses.
You know, we've seen these social scientific studies that show the left doesn't understand what the right is saying nearly as well as the right understands what the left is saying. Makes perfect sense, right? We live in a left-wing culture, so obviously we're just going to know the arguments on the other side. But if you don't know what the other side really thinks – It's easy to fill your head with all these fears and sort of scary things.
No,
and
I
shut them up.
I agree. Prager always says, we know them, they don't know us. Every airport in the United States has CNN running 24/7.
Yep.
It's not avoidable.
Yeah.
It's part of the culture. The Los Angeles Times, I live in Los Angeles, that's right here. It's ubiquitous. It's impossible to not know what the left is saying. I do totally believe that if the left got to know voices like Thomas Sowell or Dennis Prager or something, they would have a completely different understanding of that. But it's also part of it is the narcissism of not seeking it out.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
There's a certain narcissism in it. It's very accessible. It's out there. You can find it. All you need is your phone to find Thomas Sowell, Dennis Prager, and all these different voices out there, Ben Shapiro, any of these voices, Michael Knowles, any of these voices out there, you're not seeking them out. And I don't think that you can craft an opinion, an argument, or debate unless you're aware of what the other people are saying. So I like to hear what everyone's saying.
Absolutely.
Not for them,
yeah.
For me.
But
I got to craft something. I need their input. I want to watch game film. In other words, I'm trying to put together a defensive scheme. I need to watch some game film. I'm not going to not watch the game film. I want to study the team.
But that point requires humility. I mean, the humility, I think, is the key here. We now celebrate pride as a virtue in the culture. But if you think, maybe I don't know everything, maybe I need to hear the other point of view, maybe I need to work on my arguments, that requires a humility. You think of like the smartest guy that ever lived, Socrates. He said, I don't know anything. And you know what they did to that guy? He didn't live a long, happy life, you know. And I think it's a rare virtue these days.
It also requires a desire to actually understand the truth, a desire to learn. Listen, as a consumer of news, I don't know a single place you can go to get the news. I try to hear from people on the left, the right, libertarians. I try to hear a range of things and synthesize somewhere in the middle. In today's, you see it in Hollywood, you see it in big business, you see it in journalism, there's an element in which politics is like the clothing of morality. It's virtue signaling where it doesn't really matter. You know, we had protests all over in Black Lives Matter, and I had a friend of mine who sent an email, you know, why aren't you out protesting? And I'm like, look, I have been passionate about civil rights my entire life. There's a reason that I was the only U.S. senator in the Senate to go to Nelson Mandela's funeral. There's a reason why I represented pro bono a capital defendant who was wrongfully convicted of murder before the U.S. Supreme Court and got exonerated based on DNA evidence. There's a reason I've spent 30 years fighting for school choice, because civil rights are powerful and profound and meaningful, but you actually have to care about the substance. You look at polling right now where you ask people, do you agree with Black Lives Matter? And naturally, everyone says, yes, it's a truism. Of course, Black Lives Matter. Yes, Black Lives Matter. Like,
it's like saying good things are good. Everybody agrees with that statement.
But that is different from the organization that's called Black Lives Matter, where the organizers are avowed Marxists. They state, we are Marxist. We're seeking the overthrow of the government. We want to abolish the police. That's not the truism that, yes, Black Lives Matter. And by the way, what the group Black Lives Matter is advocating would kill more African Americans. You abolish the police and you will see low-income people dying at a greater rate. I want to protect them, and it's the reason I spent 30 years fighting to do so. But you've got to actually care about the substance, not just I'm putting a bumper sticker on my car to show how woke I am.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. And not only that, but when you put the bumper sticker on that says, you know, tolerance with all the different symbols or whatever, inclusivity or whatever it says on there, you're also appeasing yourself and your neighbors. You're sort of letting yourself off the hook. It's basically the version of that was, I gave at the office.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Yeah. That was the running joke. The kid comes by, March of Dimes. I gave at the office. Like, don't bother me. I already did. I put the bumper sticker on the Prius. I put coexist on my Prius. I'm done. I did my work.
I had this big fear when the rioters were coming up through L.A. They were going down Sunset Boulevard. It was right where I live. And I have an American flag in the back of my car, just right in the back windshield. And I thought, you know, that flag's not so popular with the rioters these days. I don't want to lose my windshield. Should I take it out? And I thought, well, if I take out the flag to appease the mob, why was I flying it in the first place? What's the point of that flag? But these symbols now, appeasing the mob, don't appease the mob, they're taking on a lot of importance.
I know you guys have a hard out. Your people are saying you got to get out of here, and I got to get out of here too. So, because I feel like we could go on for 5 hours with this discussion. So hopefully we'll do it again soon. Let me just hit Simply Safe. No one should feel unsafe at home, period. And that's why there is Simply Safe. They're on a mission, and that mission is to provide security for you and your family. Free shipping, and you can just go to simplysafe.com/Adam. The podcast, it's also a video podcast, Verdict with Ted Cruz, is excellent. It's short, little, digestible, seems to be about 35, 40-minute chunks. They pretty much stay on a subject, and at the end of that, you become an expert on that subject. Michael Knowles, as well, you can find over at let's see, with Shapiro, right?
Yeah, over at the Shapiro crew, over at the Daily Wire.
Daily Wire, Michael J. Knowles with a K. MichaelJKnowles.com is where you go. Ted Cruz, TedCruz.org is where you go, and shoot him a tweet at Ted Cruz as well. You can go to AdamCarolla.com. I'm doing live shows, coming to Texas, coming to Addison, doing the improv, then coming back to San Antonio. Who's scared to travel? Not this comedian. So go to AdamCarolla.com. I'm your emotional support animal. My book is back up on Amazon, so check that out as well. Ed Calderon's going to come on tomorrow and get us caught up all things Mexico and narco and all that kind of stuff. Ted, Michael, this has been a delight. And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Ted Cruz and Michael Knowles saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744 and pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. Get the links at adamcarolla.com.
Video calls, meal planning, raising little humans. I don't have time to research tires. DiscountTire.com with Treadwell makes it easy. It's my personal tire guide. I get trustworthy recommendations for tires based on my needs and driving habits. I click buy, I click book an appointment, I drive up. And now, with their touchless experience, I can even stay in my car during the service. Boom. Discount Tire.
A lot has changed over the years, except when it comes to paying for gas. That is, until now. Now at Come & Go, you can pay right from your phone with the Come & Go app. It's as easy as tap, pay, go. Plus, you'll earn rewards instantly with every fuel up. Download the Come & Go app today and experience the future of fueling at Come & Go.